Welcome to the Look Far podcast, Voices from the Wild. Join Look Far Conservation as we talk to conservation leaders from around the world about their work, their life, the challenges they face, and the successes they've had.
Today we're kicking off season two of the Look Far podcast, Voices from the Wild, with our friends at Wetlands International, who work to protect the world's great wetlands, obviously. We'll discuss with them the threats facing wetland ecosystems, such as unsustainable agriculture, mining, and fires. We'll talk about how Wetlands International shapes its conservation strategies around engagement with local communities, a process driven by science and data, but grounded in relationships with people. And we'll discuss the fires in the Pantanal over the past handful of years, which have rivaled, if not exceeded, the fires in the Amazon in their devastation. We'll talk about how Wetlands International sought to respond and empower local communities in the face of these fires, including in particular the Cajueo indigenous communities with whom they work. All that and more coming up. Welcome to season two.
Wetlands International is an organization that is strongly based on science, on research, but we do consider and take a lot into our work and interventions the local knowledge, the local perceptions, and the belonging of people. It's actually, they were fighting the fires with sandals. There were some people, some local communities with equipment, but it was really hard for them to fight. They were very dealing with the fires however they could.
The positive side of all these fires is that people have become more aware of what happens when wetlands are not functioning correctly, when wetlands have no water to provide their services. And it's become evident that we lose a lot. We lose a lot of benefits from wetlands.
All ecosystems are highly complex, but you know, only with wetlands is that complexity so apparent. And I think for all the challenges facing wetlands, does that complexity of confronting those challenges, you know, seem appropriate? And that's why we're so excited today to have our friends from Wetlands International joining us to talk about their work. The work of Wetlands International, I think, wisely embraces the complexity that you see in wetlands, blending advocacy, technical assistance, science, community-driven management approaches that sometimes, you know, are quite literally designed to sort of flow with the rivers and the channels and streams and the prevailing culture and social and economic imperatives of many of the world's great wetland ecosystems. And with that, I'm joined as my co-host today, a Look Far colleague, Marlies Quirino, who is going to introduce our guests. Marlies.
Thank you, Scott. I'm happy to be here. Yes, so today we're talking to Gaston Fulquet and Rafaela Nicolas from Wetlands International, and specifically on their work on the so-called Corridor Azul program. And Corridor Azul literally means blue corridor in Spanish and Portuguese. And this program started in 2017, and it aims to safeguard the health and connectivity of the Paraná-Paraguay river system and its iconic wetlands of the Iberá marshes and the Paraná Delta in Argentina and the Pantanal in Brazil. So this whole program spans over 3,400 kilometers and is one of the largest free-flowing river systems in the world. So first of all, Gaston and Rafaela, I'd like you to paint a picture for the audience. So where are you? Where do you work? And what does it look like? 3,400 kilometers is a big area.
Thank you, Marlies. And thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure to be here with you in this podcast from Look Far. It's hard to make a picture that could explain what is this beautiful and amazing area of the Corredor Azul, which is a high complex system, but at the same time extremely simple. It's the main common aspect of the Corredor Azul or the wetland systems is water. You know, water is present along the corridor and link us all. So links. These 3,400 kilometers of extension. And along this area with major rivers that are free flowing, we have iconic wetlands such as the Pantanal, the Paraná Delta, and the Iberá, which is in the middle way of between the Pantanal and the Paraná Delta. So it's the Pantanal is in the heart of South America, and everything that happens or anything that happens to this area, to this wetland, will impact the Paraná Delta, will impact the lives of all the people that are living along the system, so main cities and so forth. And I was thinking, Marlies, that just to have a slight idea of the flow in the Pantanal and also on how this interconnectedness moves. If we are to follow the journey of a small leaf that is dropped up in the northern part of the Pantanal in the Paraguay River and to the south, to the very south of the Pantanal, you would have to follow that and flow along this leaf for around 6 months. So it's quite a lot. We're talking about a giant area that embraces Paraguay, Bolivia, and Brazil, and with free-flowing rivers that move slowly through the system, bringing water, collecting water, filtering this water to people all around the region.
And that leaf, I drop it in the Pantanal, follow it for 6 months. How long do I have to follow it to eventually end up in Buenos Aires in the sea?
Yeah, that would take quite a few months, actually, almost a year for the water to that you get in Pantanal to get to the Paraná Delta. And I would like to help the listeners imagine what it looks like. And we are talking about a huge wetland mosaic that covers a large area of 17 square kilometers of floodplains, just on the final 300 kilometers of the Paraná River. So this is a very large area that connects these river systems out into the ocean through Río de la Plata. So all this river finally flows into the Atlantic Ocean. And as old sediments coming from this basin, the La Plata Basin and all its rivers, end up in this region, in the Paraná Delta, these are deposited just before it comes out into the ocean, forming thousands of islands and streams. So just so you depict this delta, it's composed by thousands of islands, streams, and rivers. And because of that proximity to the sea, connecting fresh water and marine systems, the Paraná Delta contains a high environmental heterogeneity, which provides a variety of habitats for a rich biodiversity here too. And in a way, this fundamental role of wetlands in this region of the Paraná Delta is also reflected on the fact that this region is the most densely populated area of the country. Just to complete the picture, is one of the few inhabited deltas of the world. I mean, there is a large community of islanders who developed over 100 years ago their settlements in these islands on stilt houses to be able to cope with the flooding pulses of the Paraná Delta. And it's a really lively and picturesque area of the Delta where tradition from the first settlements remains still very strong. Over the last few decades, though, there has been a huge inflow of newcomers also sharing these islands with the traditional inhabitants. And this is mainly due to an expansion of the city of Buenos Aires on this portion of the lower Paraná Delta. And well, the type of new housing that does no longer coexist with wetlands, but instead is advancing over this ecosystem and transforming them severely. So that is why this has become one of the focus areas of the program Corredor Azul.
Yeah, and Gaston and Rafaela, you know, anyone looking at a map of South America could probably put their finger on where the Amazon is. What was helpful about this was you know, the ecosystems of the Pantanal and the Paraná are, from a biological standpoint, every bit as important, but probably harder to point out and identify. And I think, too, present very different challenges in terms of how they can best be protected. Not to say that protecting the Amazon is easy. It's not. It's extremely hard. But there's a clarity to it. You know, don't cut it down. I think with wetlands, things get more complicated. So an organization like Wetlands International's work has to respond to those complications. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how you're organized. You know, how do you go about protecting these wetland ecosystems, where you are, where you're located, where you try to work, and how, as a non-governmental organization, you cover a huge, huge area that, you know, you'd need a small army to patrol adequately. And we don't think you have a small army at your disposal. So could you tell us a little bit about how you're organized, how you're structured, where you're based, and how that then supports your efforts to protect these wetland ecosystems?
All right, I'll take it from there. I think you hit the note when you said, well, wetlands are rather complex ecosystems. Out of all the variety of ecosystems we have, wetlands are probably one of the least understood yet, or least valued and socially recognized ecosystems. And I think our work starts by highlighting the value of wetlands and showing society how relevant they are, as wetlands are water and food sources, but also carbon sinks. So the condition of wetlands is directly connected to our well-being. And the fact that wetlands are disappearing 3 times faster than forests at a global level is already one entry point to highlight to society how relevant they are. I would say, in a nutshell, what we are trying to highlight is how wetlands are connectors of terrestrial and water ecosystems. So this is a way to start. So they have to be understood as part of a larger landscape in relation to other biomes, not just managed on themselves. And there is where the challenge comes. Like Rafaela said, Pantanal is very much connected to what happens in the highlands, in the Cerrado, and maybe also in the Amazon. So it's not just about managing wetlands on themselves, but understanding them as part of a larger and more complex landscape.
That's a very good question, Scott. We work through activating our network, actually. We, as you rightly said, we don't have an army working for conserving the wetlands. And it is challenging when you look at the size, the dimension of the region, and also considering that most of the threats, the changes come both from outside of the regions, but also from inside, from within. And actually, the way that we learn to working is really building capacities in one hand, and also enabling already existent capacities to come forward, to flourish, and to become partners. So Wetlands International is an organization that is strongly based on science, on research, but we do consider and take a lot into our work and interventions the local knowledge, the local perceptions, and the belonging of people. So actually, through the Corredor Azul program, we are working in partnership and collaboration with several organizations, from research institutions to local communities, the very ones who receive the benefits or the risks, or actually are made vulnerable by what happens to wetlands. It's really combining efforts to change the landscape and to make long-lasting transformations.
And Gaston, you're in Buenos Aires and Argentina, but Rafaela, you're not. Where are you?
I am in Campo Grande, Mato Grosso do Sul, in Brazil.
And as you said, Scott, always trying to connect science and policy practice for biodiversity conservation, for resilient communities, including reducing climate risks. So there is a lot of knowledge in the network that we exchange. So as a global organization, part of the Ramsar Convention, we see wetlands not just as a specific site that needs a protection, but rather as interconnected wetland system, like I said, in a landscape that are also territories of life. So what people are doing there matters, and keeping them healthy is also very much linked with the planet health and also with our well-being. I think there is a huge change over the last years on the perception that people has over wetlands. And this is really contributing for our work to be a bit easier as we get more allies and partners, like Rafaela said. So it's not only us working, but then we have a huge network of partners helping us implement, because, well, the area of work is quite challenging.
I think it sounds like it's the only way, because not only are you working in such a big area, there's so many stakeholders involved. There's, on a river, well, there'll be shipping. And I know in the region, there's in the Pantanal, there's the threat of mining. And then there's agriculture and fishing. But you can't just say, okay, stop fishing. And, you know, and to the farmer, stop growing your crops. It's about finding that balance. And it's so interesting how you manage to navigate the minefield of all these stakeholders. What would be the biggest challenge? What's the argument you always get from your so-called opponents?
Well, I think it's really an interesting question, Marley. We are on the same boat, so I wouldn't talk about opponents. So what the other party does is at the end affecting all of us as societies. Like Rafaela was explaining, one of the approaches we have in the program is actually to work with protected areas that in a way admit multiple uses. It's not just an area that needs to be kept pristine. These are territories of life and activities are taking place there. And so we try to get involved into these processes to try to find solutions on how to restore areas that have been degraded by fire or degraded by not the most better way to produce around wetlands. But yes, there are different approaches to how wetlands should be at least used. Let's find a common ground in the idea of sustainable use. And this is from where we depart a conversation with those actors that are in a way responsible for the main drivers of wetlands change and degradation. And these are very linked to the impact of our activities and our ways of consumption. So we are also part of that. There are some activities, economic activities like the ones you mentioned, that are responsible for a decrease of over 50% of wetlands in Latin America over the last 50 years. And this is very much related to an extractive model of development with activities that directly or indirectly impact the integrity of wetlands. So that is, they either alter the structure and the functioning of the wetland, which prevents them from providing these benefits to society we were mentioning at the beginning and we receive for free. So a lot of these activities have to do with transforming the hydrological functioning of the rivers, which are the bodies that provide water to wetlands. So in a way, disconnecting the river from the wetlands is what is happening due to activities such as agriculture or intensive cattling, the construction of polders. So these territories stop functioning connected to the river and they become more of a sort of highland area for more traditional sort of productions, not very adapted to the functioning of wetlands.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the science comes in handy to prove what the effects are, because by the time you notice it and you feel the effects, it's too late. And so now, then you need the science, I suppose, to prove why it's not working, but also how to solve it? Like how can we turn it back?
Exactly. I would say, Marlies, that our work really looks both at wetlands conservation, at restoration, but planning around how we use and how we occupy territories is sort of a precondition. So this is when science comes in and we try to provide evidence of how those activities are really changing the way we can enjoy and benefit from wetlands. So much of our work is really dedicated to developing the technical capacities on how we can do things better. And so this is more of the approach of our organization. So trying to find solutions with people willing to do things better. Mm-hmm. So yes. Yeah.
And a lot has to do with our way of consumption, the Western way of consumption. And Rafaela, you mentioned that you work with local communities. I know you also work with indigenous communities. We had the privilege, Scott and I, to visit the Kajiweo people in the Pantanal. And I would love for you to tell us a little bit more about your work with them.
Yes, okay, Marlies. Well, we a little bit, as Gaston was mentioning, that one of the challenges that I see in terms of how can we change the local perceptions or approaches is also changing the perception of seeing the wetlands as an obstacle, no? And actually, this comes to why we also work with local communities and traditional knowledge. When we need to combine the technical and scientific knowledge with the knowledge and views from people that have been living for centuries or millennia in the region. So we are working with the Kajiweo indigenous communities, and we were first approached by them in 2017. They wanted to look for ways to better take care of their water, of their territory, but really considering that they have this huge land that is already in a pristine level. It's already very well preserved, but the surrounding areas of their territories are changing quite fast. So they wanted to look at this, at their land as a whole in an integrated manner, and they wanted to have more technical tools or means in order to approach that and upscale. So we engaged in first conversations with them, and they were looking at this creek and this small river that was starting to have less water for their small crop production and cattle. So it was interesting that they were trying to do everything they could to preserve that area, but they saw that the waterborne was was being affected from the outside, and this embraces their sacred ground. We started to discuss with them that the integrated planning was needed for the region as a way to manage their land by agreeing with different leaders in the area. And we approach that through a life plan. So the life plan is actually an indigenous perception of the territory and where they plan their life, their existence, their sustainability, their dreams, where they develop their sacred relations to the ground, and also develop economies that are in line with sustaining that land. So the life plan is actually a management plan with all the elements or ingredients that we need to have a better existence and a vibrant life. So basically, then we started to facilitate these dialogues among the five indigenous communities that are within the territory. And it came up beautifully as a management plan with clear guidelines and a clear assessment of what are the main species that need to be recovered, what species they need for making their art craft, for making their ceramic, where do they need to go to restore that. We also started to discuss what can be done then. So one of the challenges in the region is the loss of native species and the loss of species due to the fires. As probably many of the listeners must have heard, the fires in 2020 in the Pantanal have affected largely several communities and several landscapes. And actually, the Cajuel was one of the areas affected. So they have always been concerned of how to maintain their territory and maintain those species for their future and for the coming generations. We started to develop a nursery for restoration in an area where the restoration plan was never was never developed. So it was very much learning from scratch with the local communities, but at the same time, bringing already existent experiences from other areas in the Pantanal and from other areas which work with nurseries to develop that. Now the local community has an ongoing nursery which has around 700 seedlings. And from that, there are 10 native species which are being reproduced. And this is the first time that these species are being reproduced. And it's really thanks for the combining effect of the traditional knowledge, which the local communities have really put on the table and bring together with the experts that are working in the region as well. And it's beautiful to see that now at least these 10 species are flourishing. You know? And one amazing aspect of this is that the work is really done by the local communities. They are the ones that are inspiring us to move forward, you know, because they are the ones that go to the nursery on the daily basis and pour water, see what is needed to change or to adapt, and they are the ones that map where the seeds are, where we can find native seeds in the territory. And we're not talking about a small landscape, as I mentioned. We're talking about 3-4 hours of a road trip inside the territory in order to find the seeds, and sometimes in a very warm or hot condition.
One of the biggest takeaways, and this is now, we were there last in 2019, toward the end of 2019, so a few years ago now, in hearing about the fires in the Pantanal, and that, if I recall, a larger area of the Pantanal burned than was burned in the Amazon that same year, which was a very bad year for fires in the Amazon. And there really can be nothing more hopeless than dealing with fires at that scale, because these are landscapes where there's no road where you can just drive a truck down, hook up to a hydrant and start blasting water. These are inaccessible areas. Even finding the fires can be difficult, combating them more difficult still. It's hard to move around and travel in wetlands. And so to combat that with something that's as hopeful as finding seeds, planting them, growing them, and then distributing them, and to do that through a community that's most significantly impacted by all these disruptions was powerful then, and it's inspiring still to hear about it. And I think is the kind of work that really fits the complexity of the wetlands, is you're working through that and kind of making it work for you. So that's really, really great to hear.
Thank you, Scott. It's actually been a learning process for us. And it's also great to see that this initiative is taking forward, that the nurseries are there. And now we are getting to a second stage of upscaling. So through a local community and a local association in the Cajuel Indigenous Territory, there's an initial effort to develop another nursery in a faraway area of the territory. So this has inspired other communities inside the territory, the Cajuel territory, and outside to try the same experience and to really try to replicate in their area. So now we're We are developing this in the Barro Preto community, which is the Cajuel community that is based in an area that they consider a sacred land, and where there are several species that are under threat or endangered. And those are the species that they want to target in the coming phase of the Corredor Azul project.
One story I found remarkable, back in 2020, we spoke briefly and you said, well, something amazing happened, because we checked, oh, how, are you okay? What about the fires and the Cajueo people? And you said, well, something remarkable happened because the federal fire brigade of the government wasn't able to get to the territory soon enough. And so the Cajueo started their own fire brigade. And if I remember correctly, you actually went and bought all the protective gear and whatever they would need, suits and helmets and axes and just gear to protect themselves, and brought it to them for these guys in the Cajueo to go into the woods and actually protect themselves from the fire. And from there, now this community has seen, okay, so we can combat the fires. Let's now restore the lands as well.
Yes, thank you, Marlies. Actually, they were fighting the fires with sandals. There were some people, some local communities with equipment, but it was really hard for them to fight. They were very dealing with the fires, however they could. And to me and to us as an organization, it really struck us that, wow, it's... They are the living example that they are fighting for the wetlands, and through fighting for wetlands, they are fighting for their lives. That's an example that should be taken globally. They are living there on a daily basis, and it's very natural. We should protect. It's catching fires. Well, we need to do something about that. Or it's being illegally logged. We need to do something about it. But As further we get from nature, we started to detach ourselves from this truth. No, so I think that when we bring these examples to life and make these examples more visible, it's just a way to make it clear that our lives depend on nature. You know,
that's great. So we're coming up on our time, and we should start to wrap up. Gaston.
Yes.
What do you see ahead? Challenges, things that give you hope, things you want to do. Tell us what the next couple of years you think looks like for your work in the Paraná, for Wetlands International in South America, and so forth.
I think for the coming years, fires like Rafaela was commenting have affected the whole corridor due to a severe drought in the region and changes in the water regime. So the panorama is not really the best to work. And so I want to call the attention that there are severe changes in the system, and this is already a fact that we have to work with. On the other hand, and looking more into the positive side of these tragedies along our corridor and our wetlands, I think this has really mobilized a lot of actors that weren't really looking at wetlands before. And I'm talking about just 2 or 3 years ago, wetlands were not so present in the public agenda. So the positive side of all these fires is that people have become more aware of what happens when wetlands are not functioning correctly, when wetlands have no water to provide their services. And it's become evident that we lose a lot. We lose a lot of benefits from wetlands. So I think this is kind of for the coming years, I see that there is a possibility really to progress, not only because of a law. I mean, a law is just a part of the whole story, but this awareness of society on the fundamental role of wetlands is also pushing for people to try to think how we interact with nature, how we relate with nature, and how we can do things a bit better in the near future. So I see for the really in the midterm a possibility for a big change in terms of how we understand wetlands, and I think we are at a point that we are becoming aware that these drivers of change really affect the functioning of ecosystems in a way that we don't completely understand. So it's better for us to try to first understand the system and how to work with the forces of nature and wetlands and how we better adapt to it. I think the pandemic had a lot to do with this change of mindset at a civil society level. So I'm optimistic despite the fact that there is a lot of transformation.
Yeah, I mean, Marlies, I don't know about you, but I mean, I think what Gaston is saying about even in just the past couple of years, things have been changing and changing in a positive direction. Doesn't mean the threats are any less grave. In some cases, the threats are keeping up, but a lot of great work is being done. And when we take time to sit and talk to people like Rafaela and Gaston, we see evidence that, you know, good things are happening as a result.
And I think thanks to them also, what Gaston said was spot on. If we don't understand the effects of what we're doing, the effects on these wetland systems, we can't do anything about it. So the awareness and the understanding is key.
Absolutely. Well, Rafaela and Gaston, thank you so much for making time for us today. This was a great discussion, and let's keep in touch. And as I find, I'm always saying, next time we check in on you, let's all sit around a table together and talk without any screens in front of us.
Oh, that would be wonderful, Scott and Marlies, to see you and to hug you and to be able to share this face to face. It's quite a different approach, I think. So we thank you so much for the opportunity of letting us bring a bit of how we try to contribute to this relation between nature and society, which I think is very much on the global agenda today, how we relate to nature and how this is not a matter only about how we keep biodiversity, but the underlying matter is it's a matter of also our survival as a species. So I think it is much deep-rooted than what we are seeing, but we are getting to this point as society to try to see that this connection. So having the opportunity to share that, it's incredible. And also it's an opportunity for us to get to know others who can help and are willing to contribute to our work. So thanks for the space.
Thank you so much, Scott, Marlies as well. It's been wonderful. And I really hope that next time we can see each other either on one of the parts of the Paraná-Paraguay wetland system or inside the Pantanal in the heart of South America. So.
That sounds great. I can't wait. And thanks again. And we'll talk to you soon.
LookFAR is a U.S. 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to defending wild and wondrous places and working with the people living in and among them. More at lookfar.org.